So Shabbat Shalom, Jumma Mubarak, TGIF, happy Friday, happy weekend, and it's also Memorial Day. Memorial Day, different from Veterans Day, in that Memorial Day is the day that we remember those who died in battle on behalf of the United States. More than a million soldiers now since the founding of this country, a horrific number, and one that we really need to take seriously. This isn't, spend some time contemplating that on Monday beyond just the parties of the day. By the way, our quote for the day, patriotism is easy to understand in America. It means looking out for yourself by looking out for your country, Calvin Coolidge, of all people. And our contest for the day for the best entry in our blog, we will be giving away a copy of Cracking the Code, How to Win Hearts, Change Minds, and Restore America's Original Vision, book by me, for the best entry on the homepage of TomHartmann.com. It being Friday, as always, we start with Senator Bernie Sanders. He's neither a Democrat nor a Republican. He was the longest-serving independent in the House of Representatives. He is now in the United States Senate representing the great state of Vermont, but I like to think of him as America's senator. He comes on this program every week and has for many, many years, answering questions from people all over the United States. Our national town hall, our brunch with Bernie Day. Senator Sanders, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you. The veterans legislation, the GI Bill of Rights, John McCain couldn't be bothered to show up and vote for the thing. In fact, he spoke out against it, but it looks like it's got a veto-proof majority.
Well, here's what's happening. I think, as most listeners know, this war in Iraq has been an absolute disaster. We've lost 4,000 soldiers, over 30,000 have been wounded. What we're really worried about now is tens and tens of thousands coming back with post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury. We've got a real problem. Meanwhile, over the years, the kind of educational benefits available to our veterans has declined significantly in real dollars. You know, Tom, because we've discussed this before, that after World War II, one of the most significant pieces of legislation ever passed by the Congress was the GI Bill of Rights, which provided a huge bonus, a huge amount of money to enable those veterans of World War II to go to college.
The GI Bill was what moved my father from my grandfather being basically a first-generation Norwegian immigrant who was on the edge of poverty solidly into the middle class. He was able to buy his home. He was able to go to college, all because of the GI Bill.
And you can't believe how often people, just even senators and others, are saying that's what happened. You know, my father got the GI Bill of Rights. My grandfather got the GI Bill. And what it did is not only improve the opportunities for the soldiers themselves, the veterans themselves, but it had a huge impact on our economy because it enabled an entire generation to get the education they otherwise would not have gotten. And that meant full tuition, a stipend, housing costs, and so forth. But over the years, those benefits have, in real dollars, significantly gone down. What we did yesterday is pass a new GI educational bill, which will make it possible for those people who have served in Iraq and Afghanistan and in the future to get a quality education. And we're very, very excited about that. It remains to be seen whether Bush will eventually sign this bill or whether he'll veto it. He claims there is too much money because we're spending $51 billion over a 10-year period. Meanwhile, he is spending $12 billion every single month in the war in Iraq. So it's okay to spend 4 months of the war in Iraq, $48 billion, but we can't spend $50 billion to provide educational opportunity for 10 years for the men and women who served in Iraq and Afghanistan. So we're going to work on that. We have the other significant thing about that vote is that we had a number of Republicans just deserting the president. As we did last week on a vote on the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, and that is stopping oil from going into that. So what you are seeing now nationally and politically is that Republicans are understanding how politically toxic George W. Bush is, and I have the feeling from now until Election Day, you'll be hearing Republicans say, George Bush, gee, I know the name, but I don't remember the face. Who is that guy? Not somebody I've ever supported. But I hope people remember that for 7.5 years, our Republican friends have marched in lockstep behind Bush. Now, they're going to be running away from him.
You know, on this program, I regularly bring on conservatives and debate them pretty much every day, you know, for at least the 5-10 minutes. And for years, I mean, this is our sixth year of our program, and for years they would come on and proudly say, I'm a Republican, I'm a conservative. Some of them even had names like the CNS News, which is now called CNS News. It used to be called the Conservative News Service. And in the last couple of months, I can't tell you how many of them. I'll bring them on, and I'll introduce them, and I'll say, you know, representing the conservative point of view, representing the Republican point of view, and they'll say, no, I'm an independent.
Right, everybody is an independent now. Right.
No, I'm not a Republican. I'm an independent. I'm not a conservative. I'm an independent. You know, it's...
All of that is everybody knows. That's what they're going to do coming up to the election. And actually, we saw somebody had leaked some kind of memo that came from Republican headquarters or some consultant who's saying, run away from the president.
Right.
Distance yourself as far as you can.
Rebrand the party.
Right. He is toxic. Yeah. Now, the other issue, obviously, that is on people's mind, that is just a huge, huge issue, and that is these rapidly rising costs of gas and oil. And Congress is beginning, very, very slowly, to begin to address this issue. We passed the legislation which will go into effect on July 1st. Bush didn't want it, but he has to do it. We had an overwhelming vote on it. Stopping oil from going into the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. It's a minor effort, but it may have some impact. We passed something called the repeal of the Enron loophole, not as strong as it should be. That was in the Ag Bill. And what that is about is part of a very, very big deal, which my office is going to get into very heavily. And that is everybody understands with the oil companies, the ExxonMobils and Shell and BP and the other companies are ripping off the American people big time. They're enjoying record-breaking profits, giving their CEOs huge salaries and compensation packages. But we also have to keep our eye on the Goldman Sachs people of the world, J.P. Morgan, and these financial institutions, which are heavily involved in speculating on oil futures. And there are some people who really think that as much as half of the cost of oil now is attributable to that speculation. Not a lot of people understand the issue. It's complicated. Most significantly, a lot of this speculation, almost by definition, is done below the radar screen. There's no transparency. It's done in the dark. And that is an issue we are going to work very, very hard on, because we think if we can expose them, if we can talk about the profiteering, the manipulation of the market that is taking place, we might be able to significantly lower gas and oil prices. I should tell you, Tom, that on my website, which is sanders.senate.gov, we have asked people in Vermont, but around the country, to tell us what the impact of high gas and oil prices has been for them and their families. And the responses that we're getting are huge. We're getting huge numbers of responses. And the stories that we're hearing, especially from rural Vermont, rural America, are just unbelievable. People finding it harder and harder to get to the doctor, get to the grocery store. We're talking about people who are going cold, whose kids are getting sick because they can't adequately heat their homes in the wintertime. Old people making the choice between prescription drugs and food or whether they heat their homes. And on it goes. So this oil situation is a huge problem which has got to be addressed. Long term, of course, as you and I have discussed many times, and I think most people understand, we've got to break our dependency on foreign oil. We've got to break our dependency on fossil fuel. We've got to move to energy efficiency. We've got to move to sustainable energy. And let me just reiterate, because I'm on both of the committees that deal with these issues, the potential is absolutely extraordinary. What we need is a new Manhattan-type project where we're investing significantly in solar thermal, in photovoltaics, in wind, in geothermal, in biomass. It's sitting there today, rebuilding our transportation system, our rail system. We can, in fact, in a very vigorous and rapid way, move away from fossil fuels. If you think of the challenge, Tom, that America faced in 1941 after Pearl Harbor, the need to rebuild the economy to a war economy rather than a consumer economy, mobilize millions of people to fight on two fronts. We did this within a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And if we look at this challenge of global warming, the challenge of the high price of gas and oil, and we invested in it, we mobilized our people, we could do that. We really could do that. And in the process, I believe very, very strongly, we can create millions of good-paying jobs, clean up the environment. Sadly and tragically, on this issue, as on so many others, we have a president who hasn't a clue. Not a clue.
Well, we have an oil industry president.
We have an oil industry. here. I mean, you know, what any sensible president would have done months and months and months ago is brought all of these oil executives into the White House and say, stop ripping off the American people.
Yeah.
But obviously not this president.
No, he's not going to say that to his old buddies and his peers. It's tragic. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. His website, sanders.senate.gov. There's a great newsletter over there. Always lots of great information. You can check that out. If you want to speak with Senator Sanders, he will be taking your calls. 866-303-2270. Our telephone number.
Tom Hartman. Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
The hour here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program, brought to you in part by the Teamsters, fighting to stop the unfair trade deal with Colombia. Find out more at Teamster, that's singular, Teamster.org. It's our brunch with Bernie, our Senator Bernie Sanders, holding his national town meeting right here on our program, taking your calls from all over the United States, 866-303-2270, our telephone number, TomHartman.com, if you want to participate in our live chat room. And Bernie, ready to pick up some calls here?
Let's do it.
Okay, Bob in New York City, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, good afternoon, sir. Given the Department of Energy's latest statement, there are trillions of barrels of oil on our own domestic soil. The House and Senate recently passed a bill to allow lawsuits of OPEC for restricting supply. Aren't the U.S. House and Senate doing exactly the same thing by restricting the access to our own domestic oil we have here?
By what? Not producing more domestically?
Yeah, basically by not drilling in Anwar and
well,
like
I think
offshore.
I know that that's what the Bush administration tells us. If you listen to what the Department of Energy actually says, and this is what the Energy Information Administration says, they said, and I quote, drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge would only reduce gasoline prices by a penny per gallon, and only in 20 years when drilling is at or near peak production. So I think you're looking at a minuscule amount of savings in terms of the cost of gas at a great, great environmental risk. I think there is infinitely more potential in moving toward energy efficiency. I know that in my state of Vermont, which has done a pretty good job, we can do a lot better. We have had a dramatic impact in the amount of electricity, for example, that people are utilizing. We know the potential now to have automobiles and electric cars that are infinitely more efficient than what we're currently using. I have been talking to people who see the potential of what we call solar thermal plants in the southwest of this country, which can produce 20-25% of the electricity that we consume in the United States of America. These are plants. There's one that will be online, we think, in a couple of years, providing electricity for 400,000 homes in the West Coast with zero greenhouse gas emissions. We need to rebuild our mass transportation system. So I think that the solution is not by going into Anwar. I think it is energy efficiency. I think it is sustainable energy.
Amen, if I may. Steve in Jasper, Arizona, or Arkansas, I'm sorry. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Thanks, Tom. Hi, Bernie. I love you, and I love your ideas on the renewables and all that. But I guess my question is, do you really think that anything's going to get accomplished with the partisanship that's going on in Congress right now? And I think people are just fed up with, you know, Congress not getting anything done on any of this.
Let me just say this, Steve. I don't think the problem is, quote-unquote, partisanship. I think the reason for inactivity is, number one, you have a president who is a right-wing extremist who would veto any significant piece of legislation that protected working people or protected our environment or stood up to the powerful special interests who have funded him and his friends for so many years. What I think we need to do is build a very strong grassroots movement around a progressive agenda, which, among many other things, says to the Congress that it is absolutely imperative that we move away from fossil fuel, that we create millions of jobs by moving to energy efficiency and sustainable energy. And I think when that ground, that grassroots movement begins to roll, it can have an impact. Let me just give you an example. For a number of months, most of the Republicans were expressing opposition to this very important veterans educational bill, which we just passed yesterday. But because virtually every veterans organization in this country representing millions of veterans said, wait a second, we have to move this legislation forward. If we're serious about protecting veterans' needs, that's what we have to do. You know what? Republicans started crumbling right and left. They don't want to go home on a Memorial Day weekend and say they voted against the most significant veterans education bill in 60 years. So the trick here is not to believe this partisanship and all of that stuff. The trick is to elect progressive members to the Congress to get rid of this president, put a progressive president in office, and keep the momentum moving for us to stand up to the very powerful big money interests who have so much influence over what goes on here.
And build it from the ground up. Pat in Oklahoma City, you're on with Senator Sanders. We have about a minute before the break.
Thank you, Tom. Thank you, Senator Sanders, for all that both of you do for all of us. I would like to suggest that one of the best ways that we can start a good movement in this country to educate people of what the Constitution says is to bring it back to the classroom, have everybody study the Constitution, know what it says. That way, we can't have an administration that tells the people that, well, if the president does it, then it's not against the law. Everybody should know what the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and the Declaration of Independence has to do with this.
Bernie, we'll pick up your thoughts on that on the other side of the break.
Okay? Very good. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Pat. Your comments are very well said. It is 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. Our brunch with Bernie, our Senator Bernie Sanders. His website, sanders.senate.gov. Ours, TomHartman.com and AirAmerica.com. Our number, 866-303-2270.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
Tom Hartman radio program, our brunch with Bernie segment, Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov for his website and his great newsletter, by the way, that goes out regularly with what's not just what Bernie's up to, but, you know, what's happening all over the country, what's happening in the Senate, wherever you live. I think you'll find it of value. 1-866-303-2270. James, and you
probably... Tom, we were going to respond to Pat.
Oh, that's right. Thank you, Bernie. You are so good at keeping me on track.
Pat raised a very good issue. She is concerned that a lot of young people who go to school really have no strong knowledge about what our Constitution is about, and that we do not do anywhere near as good a job as we should about educating our kids about the history of this country, about how they can be involved in the political process. And I just couldn't agree with her more. And that's just something we've got to focus on. Generally, those decisions are made at the statewide level. But I hope we can introduce the concept of civics in schools all over this country, that our teachers become familiar with the Constitution. It is a great document.
Yeah.
And the more we learn about it, the better people will be able to stand up to those folks who say we have to give up our constitutional rights every single day.
Yeah, and if I may, your colleague Jim Jeffords was his whole, you know, his big issue, and the only Republican that I ever voted for, and we had children in the public schools in the 1980s, and we were living down in Georgia at the time. And in the 1950s and 60s, when I was in school, we learned the Constitution. In fact, we had to memorize the preamble of the Constitution. We had to memorize the Bill of Rights. And in the 1980s, when Reagan became president, there was a purging of our schools that is still going on now in our colleges with David Horowitz and his campaign, where the conservatives were yelling in the school boards. I remember there's a big deal in Atlanta about these socialist teachers because they are union members, and these textbooks that talk about the Wobblies and the union activity back in the 19th century, and how dare they? And there was a purging of basically history and civics from our classrooms as a result of these right-wing efforts during the Reagan administration, and we haven't seen the Constitution back in our classrooms since then, and I think it's a shame. And now we have only five companies that of any significance that manufacture all the textbooks for the United States, and they all have to be vetted by the state of Texas.
Right. Now, this is a huge issue.
Wrong.
I'm glad you're focusing on it.
It's just wrong. Yeah. I this is a regular rant of mine. It makes me crazy. Okay, let's go back to James in New Paltz, New York. Hey, James.
Yeah, good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hi.
Senator Sanders, a quick question. We know today that Carvel was subpoenaed by John Conyers, in relation to the malicious prosecution of Don Siegelman. And my question to you is, I know not totally relevant, but is there anything you and the Senate can do to support Congressman Conyers in his efforts?
Yeah, I think, to be very honest with you, it's not been an issue that I have focused on, but I know enough to know that it is an area that we have got to look further at. And I know, Tom, you have spoken. I know you've done an interview with Singleman.
We've had him on the show twice, yeah.
Yeah, all right. And to answer the caller's question, yes, this is an issue that I and some of my colleagues will work on in support of what John Conyers is doing in the House.
Okay. Will in Hartford, Connecticut, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, guys. Thanks so much for taking my call. Senator, I had a question. I was wondering if you had a chance to read Joseph Lieberman's op-ed in the Journal yesterday.
No, I didn't.
It basically talks about the sort of how the Democratic Party has drifted away from the fundamentals that were sort of galvanized in the 40s when we faced, you know, Nazi Germany, and further galvanized in the 60s with Kennedy, and that basically we've gone soft and used most recently Obama's willingness to talk to Iran as proof of that. And I, as a fellow independent, and I guess I can use that in quotes when it comes to Lieberman these days, I wanted to get your take looking at both parties in that aspect.
Well, I think anything that Senator Lieberman says now has got to be taken in the context, of course, of his strong support for Senator McCain and the very important role that he's going to play with Republicans to see that Obama is defeated. But I obviously have strong disagreements with Senator Lieberman on that point. My criticism of the Democratic Party is, in fact, that it has lost contact with the working people of this country, that it has supported policies which have turned their back on the need for a national health care system, on real tax reform, on trade policies which protect workers rather than the CEOs of large corporations. I think there are very few workers out there who will say, yeah, I really believe that the Democratic Party is fighting for me every day. They'll say, in most cases, that the Democrats are far superior to right-wing extremists who control the Republican Party, but I don't think there is a wave of enthusiasm for the Democratic Party. I think in terms of foreign policy, clearly, as we know, Lieberman has been a very, very strong supporter of Bush's war in Iraq. I think history will show that war has been an absolute disaster, not only for the people of Iraq and for our country in terms of our loss of life and our loss of treasury, perhaps over $1 trillion at the end of the game, or maybe even a lot more. But even more significantly, it has been a sidetrack. We have been sidetracked from the real fight against international terrorism. Osama bin Laden remains alive and well. Al-Qaeda is growing. The battles in Afghanistan are not going particularly well. The prestige that we are held all over the world has declined precipitously, which is not going to help us in the fight against international terrorism. So I think the role that Joe Lieberman is going to be playing is in support of McCain, in support of the war in Iraq, and to turn on those people like Obama who understand that you can't make progress unless you talk to people who disagree with you. No big deal talking to your allies. You got to sit down and talk to people who disagree with you. In fact, maybe one of the successes of the disastrous Bush foreign policy has been their negotiating with the people in North Korea. And I have supported that effort. So I have never believed that it is a mistake to sit down and talk to people. That is a lot better than seeing people die in war, and getting wounded in war, and spending huge sums of money. So I think Senator Liebman is dead wrong on this.
Mm-hmm. Mike in Charlottesville, Virginia, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Senator. The Senate and House have been controlled by Democrats for going on 18 months now, and the leadership's been extremely feckless. Every time Mr. 21% popularity George Bush threatens a veto or stamps his feet, you know, Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi roll over and give up whatever it is they're looking for, whether it's S-CHIP or ending the war. So what I'm wondering is, you know, these leaders are there only through the forbearance of the rest of the Democrats. And I'm wondering if the Democrats just enjoy sucking? Do they get some kind of masochistic pleasure out of losing all the time? Why aren't they replacing leadership if they can't win?
Okay, well, for a start, the leadership in the House and the Senate reflects, and I speak as an independent, not as a Democrat, the consensus of the Democrats. The leadership is elected by the Democrats. And it is no secret that the Democrats have many different ideological perspectives within them. Some people who are Democrats are progressive, and some people are pretty conservative. And they have come together and elected Harry Reid, whose job it is to keep a tiny, tiny, tiny majority of 51 people, which includes Joe Lieberman, who we just discussed a moment ago, together. So when you talk about the failures or successes of the Democrats, understand they have 51 members, including Joe Lieberman, who will leave them on foreign policy issues, including some conservatives who will leave them on this or that issue. Please understand that I'm not here to tell you that I think that the Democrats have been as strong as they should. I don't believe they have been. But understand that it takes 60 votes to get anything passed in the Senate. The Republicans have exercised the filibuster over 70 times, more than any time, I believe, in the history of the Senate. And also understand that, in fact, while I would agree with the caller that the Democrats have not been as bold as they should be, and that we have not accomplished as much as I would like to see, but compared to the last 6 years, there have been some significant progress on veterans issues. Largest increase in funding for veterans health in the history of the VA. Real progress on education. Major expansion of Pell Grants. Lowering of interest loans. Debt forgiveness. Major improvements in beginning to turn around our energy policy. So we raised CAFE standards so that we're putting money now into sustainable energy and energy efficiency rather than, as was the case before, having a chairman of the Environmental Committee who thought the global warming was a hoax. So I will agree with the caller that there has not been anywhere near progress enough. I would agree with the caller that, in my view, the leadership has not been strong enough in saying to the Republicans, if you want a filibuster us, fine, we're going to be here 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, let the American people see whether we should give tax breaks to billionaires or adequately fund health care or education. So I would agree with the caller on that one. But what's going on in Washington has to be put within the context of a president who would veto any significant piece of legislation and the need for 60 votes in the Senate.
Yeah, and that's a tough one. David in Seattle, we have a half a minute before we've got to take a break. A quick question, and then maybe Bernie can pick it up on the other side.
Yeah, thank you. Senator, I heard you earlier in the program talk about the speculation of oil is driving up the prices. And yesterday, we all heard again and again about the guys up on Capitol Hill, the oil execs, saying it's supply and demand. In your opinion, what is it really, and is there going to be any relief?
Well, I think that oil company greed, I think there's a massive amount of speculation coming from the hedge funds and financial institutions. I think those are two primary causes for the outrageously high cost of oil and gas.
Thank you. 45 minutes past the hour. Brunch with Bernie on the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman. Speaking the truth that multinational corporations don't want you to know. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
9.5 minutes before the hour. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. It's the Tom Hartman Program, Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Linda in Cleveland, Ohio. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, hi, good morning. I would like to speak in defense of Congress. I think Congress has done some wonderful things, and I want to have two comments and a question. But the way I see it is that I'm concerned about the polls that show such a low approval rate for Congress. And I think one of the main problems, if not the main one, is that there's too many Republicans. They hate government, yet they want these jobs, and they go in to make it ineffective and to destroy it. So I think the motto of the Republicans seems to be nay, delay, and do little. The people who are expressing this lack of approval, I mean, do they even know who their congressperson is? Do they know what bills are before Congress today? And if they don't know these things, how can they have an informed opinion?
Well, I think Linda raises an interesting question. Obviously, I'm in a little bit of a conflict of interest here, being in the Congress. I would add, I agree with what Linda says. The media does a terrible, terrible job in covering Congress. And, in fact, telling people some of the positive developments that have taken place. I remember when we passed a very significant higher ed bill, substantially increasing Pell Grants, lowering interest rates for college loans, and providing a major debt forgiveness program, almost got no publicity at all, et cetera, et cetera. The other reason I think that Congress is held in low poll numbers is because people are disappointed that there hasn't been more aggressiveness in standing up to Bush. I think Bush will go down in history as perhaps not just one of the worst presidents we've ever had, but also one of the least popular. And people are saying, why isn't Congress standing up to him more vigorously? And I think that that is a fair criticism. So I would agree with Linda. We have accomplished perhaps a little bit more than some people know in terms of energy, education, veterans' needs. We just passed an agricultural bill where, at a time when hunger in America is increasing, more people will be eligible for food stamps. We're going to get more good food and quality food into our schools, into emergency food banks. So I think people may not know that, but I think on the other hand, as a Congress, we have got to stand up not only to Bush, but to the very, very powerful special interest who control so much of the legislation that we deal with.
Indeed. Dennis, in Woodland Hills, California, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Senator, isn't there some kind of provision in the law that would allow us to indict the guy that, in the middle of the night, put in a provision in the Medicare bill that you can negotiate drug prices with the pharmaceutical companies?
You mean the gentleman?
I can't think of his name, but he ended up getting a $1 million job.
Well, I mean, that's just, thank you for the question. That's just one example of the most significant political reality that we deal with every single day. In this case, the drug companies wrote the Medicare prescription bill, Part D. And what they did is they put in a so-called donut hole, which means seniors are going to have to pay 100% of the cost above a certain amount of money, expenses, and we can't negotiate with the government to lower the prices that Medicare has to buy prescription drugs. One of the key authors of that bill is a fellow named Billy Towson, who was then chairman of the Commerce Committee in the House. A few years after he helped write the bill, to nobody's surprise, Billy Towson ends up making a couple of $1 million a year running Pharma, which is the trade group for the pharmaceutical industry. But that's just one example. Why do you think the president and Congress have not been as strong as they should be in terms of moving to sustainable energy, in terms of trying to lower the cost of gas and electric, gas and oil? Do you think it may have something to do with the hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars in campaign contributions and lobbying going on by the energy companies? Why do you think we are the only country in the industrialized world not to have a national health care program? Does it have something to do with the enormous power of the insurance companies? Why are we paying in this country, people paying 25, 29% interest rates on their credit card? Don't think that that hasn't everything to do with the enormous power of Wall Street and the banks and the financial institutions. So the key struggle that we are involved in right now is putting people into Congress, developing a strong grassroots movement around a progressive agenda that is prepared to take on these enormously powerful people who also, by the way, control to a large degree what we see here in Reed. So we got a big fight in front of us. But I have to tell you, Tom, I am feeling much better than I have in many, many years. I think people are beginning to understand what's going on in this country and want us to move in a very different direction.
Yeah, amen. I absolutely agree with you. Jason in Boca Raton, Florida. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, Senator. I just wanted to ask you a quick question. I heard a story on NPR recently regarding recycling of waste energy generated from various industries like steel mills, even coal-fired plants. They were talking about recycling steam generated from coal-fired plants, recycling heat generated from coke ovens and steel mills. And one of the issues was that
We lost him. the wonders of the cell phone.
Yeah, Jason was making some interesting points, and I would just reiterate, potential is enormous to make our country more energy efficient. One story, and I think this is going on all over the country, in the northern part of the state of Vermont, there is an old landfill. That landfill is now providing methane gas, which in turn is providing electricity to 5,000 Vermont homes. This is from an old landfill.
Wow.
So, I mean,
when I was living there, you were generating electricity in Burlington from wood chips.
Right. Well, that's right. Wood chips we are generating in Vermont electricity from methane produced by cow manure.
Right.
So the potential for sustainable energy and energy efficiency is just, to my mind, extraordinary. And that's the direction we've got to move in.
Amen. Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov. Please get over to his website and sign up for his newsletter. Bernie, thanks so much for being
with us. Great to be with you, Tom. Thank you.
Always great talking with you. John Cusack is going to drop by, talk about his new movie, and we'll be taking your calls. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. News without conflicts of global corporate interest. The Tom Hartman Program.
Why now? In other words, were you trying to make a point, or is this just good entertainment? And I got to say, it's incredible entertainment, but you know, there is arguably a point to this movie.
I hope there's more than arguably. I think some people argue there's more of a point than the good entertainment. I think it's both, but I wanted to do something to sort of arouse people's sort of resistance of spirit, and to sort of capture their outrage and sort of shine a light on what's going on, I think, and what are some of the undercurrents of reality in this Iraq fiasco and in this privatization movement, and also within this kind of neoconservative ideology that's been, you know, a 35-year-old war to reverse the New Deal and to basically corporatize all functions of state. I was very interested in these ideas, and I think when you study what's going on in Iraq and what this, the meaning of this war, and you look at some of the great heroic journalists, you know, like Naomi Klein and Jeremy Scahill and the people who've written books, Anthony Arnov, and, you know, the list goes on and on of people who've reported on all this stuff. I think the reality is so brutal and it's so horrible that I think if you don't look at it through a different kind of lens, you know, you could never get out of bed. So to me, you know, you'd look at it through a satirical lens or an absurdist lens, and I think maybe if you can see it, you can see the situation clearly in a way.
Well,
I don't think you can look at it straight on and grasp the enormity of the corruption or the stench of you know, villainy in this thing.
Well, I think you've done a marvelous job. When the movie started, I saw the.
Yeah, and then even to amplify one point, there is, you know, as this war is, I think there's 180,000 troops and 140,000 contractors,
mm-hmm.
or it might be the other way around. It might be 140,000.
Yeah, it's the other thing. Yeah.
Right, but the point is we don't know, right?
But it's
some close there. But so we already have that reality here. So War Inc. just basically takes that this trend to its logical extension,
right.
which is a completely outsourced war.
And
it's already we're already there, but it could get worse, right?
Yeah.
So, let's say we wanted to make the argument that, okay, it would be okay for these corporations to have private armies. Well, you know, all right, it's a Darwinist world, and they're making their way out there, and they're having their products, and they're, you know, they're building, rebuilding Iraq, and someone has to do this. Well, excuse me, we're doing it. We're paying Blackwater. Exxon and Parsons aren't paying Blackwater, or Exxon isn't paying Blackwater to protect its interests over there, and Parsons isn't paying Blackwater to protect its interests. We pay the
right.
bill.
In fact, by and large,
and
they're avoiding taxes.
We not only do we pay the bill for them to protect their stuff over there, we paid for them to get there, and they helped orchestrate us getting there. So we're paying everybody. I mean, it's a completely rigged protectionist racket, and the only ones doing anything over there that signed up for it, or the U.S. taxpayer signed up for it, were the troops. And yet, they didn't have all the equipment they needed, but Blackwater does at a cost-plus basis.
Right.
But they get money straight from the State Department.
And
then they come back, and these same politicians who helped enable them, and this same kind of corporate cabal of people who do this, deny them the GI Bill of Rights.
Yeah, amen. And
so the stench of lies and hypocrisy is so mind-boggling that, you know, it makes your eyes water. So I don't know another lens to look at it beyond one of surreality or absurdity and kind of crassness. So that's the tone of the movie, and I think my only fault, I guess, would be to talk about it passionately to where I sound smarter than anybody, or that my opinion matters more than anybody, because it doesn't. But
well, I do
think that the anger and the outrage is something that I'm not sorry for, but I do believe that these ideas are important to get out there.
And at the same time, you have created a movie which is brilliantly entertaining. I just have to, lest our listeners think that what we're talking about is a dry documentary about the gore and dead bodies of war or something like that. I mean, certainly, that's the point. But when this thing opens, it opens with this quote about in the 21st century, corporations having basically taken over the functions of nation states. And I kept as the quote was rolling across, I didn't know what I had when I had the initial pre-screen DVD, and whether it was a documentary or a theatrical movie or what. And as the quote was rolling across, I thought I was waiting for the Benito Mussolini, the attribution to the quote to come. And then, boom, I'm in the middle of this incredible movie. And it's just you've done a great job. Is the Dan Aykroyd character, the vice president, I'm looking at this going, this is Dick Cheney.
Yeah, it's kind of a Dick Cheney Nixon kind of meld.
Yeah,
you know, he throws in a little bit of Tom DeLay, I think.
Yeah,
like it's like 14% Tom DeLay.
So as,
but it is you're right. I mean the film is meant all, the politics of it are going on the. They're in the film all the time, but they're also going on around in the background. And then you have a lot of kind of wonderfully absurd, fun characters that you're dealing with who are caught in sort of a Telemundo soap opera in the middle of it. But what's spinning around it is absolute anarchy and absurdity. So it's kind of an interesting mix, because the politics are sort of in your face, but they're also hidden in the background.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of might be interesting for some people.
It's brilliant. We're talking with the producer and star John Cusack of War Inc., the new movie, and what an extraordinarily thought provoking and entertaining. And you got to go see this movie. What in your mind was the hardest part of this movie to put together or to pull together?
there's been two things that were probably hardest. The easiest one was kind of conceiving it with these two wonderful writers, Mark Lehner and Jeremy Pixer. And, you know, we started writing it around the time when the statue fell, after they'd invaded Iraq. And it was pretty clear, by that point, that, they had sort of gotten away with the first stage of it. The corporate press was completely compliant, and they, you know, as they constructed this obscene green zone, this kind of feudal city amongst the, Naomi Klein calls it a carnival cruise ship amidst a sea of despair.
Yeah. The Emerald City, as it were.
The Emerald City, we call it in the movie. It became pretty clear that they were going to get away with that phase of it. And there were people even on lecterns and things saying, well, people better watch what they say. You know, I remember press spokesmen were warning people to watch how they talk. And I thought just the level of gall and the audacity of these people to try to do this and then to lecture us and to not only lecture us but threaten us. I was stunned by that. So we thought, well, let's try to be as obscene as they are hypocritical, and let's just see where it takes us.
Mm-hmm.
And so we really followed that, I think, where we never pulled any punches. So that was an easy part, but getting the financing from the financing to do it was very difficult. And then actually getting the movie distributed and getting it out has been very difficult too, because we haven't had any, real kind of support or corporate support really for the movie. All of the support has been from people who write in non-traditional kind of media outlets, like the normal people who write about movies in that sort of insular community. They all say, well, it's too close to home, or, you know, it's not funny enough because, we're, you know, the war's still going on and you shouldn't be doing this. Or they say, it makes you uncomfortable and it's not funny. It makes you groan, as if, you know, the movie's only job is to just give you escapism. I think some people think the movie's hilarious, and I think it is, and I think a lot of other people do, but the idea that, you know, you don't make us uncomfortable, I think is a very apt description of the problem people seem to have with the movie.
Well, our big media corporations make a good chunk of their change. I mean, some of them are actually defense contractors like GE and NBC, and others just are making a whole lot off war. I mean, it just, war brings eyeballs to TV screens. We'll be back with the rest of our interview with John Cusack in just a moment. 16 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartmann Program on Air America Radio. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program, where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person?
Minutes past the hour, we're talking with John Cusack.
I mean, the film is a lower budget kind of punk rock movie, and we did it for a small budget, and we just got all this great cast there to go do it, and it's very experimental, and it's very punk rock. It's just, we just did it, but all the support's coming from, you know, amazing journalists and writers and political shows and things, and then the corporate media has just come to the party late because we've gotten so much support from people like, you know, Naomi Klein and Jeremy Scahill and Air America and all these organizations, Crooks and Liars, Raw Story. You know, we've gotten amazing support virally.
Yeah.
And then now the corporate media has come on because of that, and we've gotten some stories and, you know, some big papers and things. But there's people who talk about the movie the way you do, saying it, they love it, and it's this great thing. And then there are people who absolutely try to savage it.
Well, I think it's a great movie as a movie, and it's the kind of thing that people are going to, after they go see the movie, they're going to sit around and say, hey, let's go have a drink and talk for an hour about this.
Yeah, that would be great. I mean, our hope was that it would, you know, you could do whatever you want with it, as long as it inspires you to think and also kind of gets you to feel something and do something, you know, and get active about it. And whether it's just reclaiming your spirit and reclaiming your sense of defiance is a first step.
Yep.
You know, I think that has a lot of value. Like there's a great quote from Arundhati Roy, you know, the great writer who's written about that. And, you know, to paraphrase her, saying that, you know, the strategy should be to not only to confront empire, but to lay siege to it, you know, to deprive it of oxygen, to shame it, to mock it, with the ability to tell our own stories. And they're different stories than the ones we're being kind of brainwashed to believe.
Absolutely. She was one of the first and the most brilliant to speak out against the war in Afghanistan, actually.
Yeah.
The original invasion there, which is...
And I think, you know, she also spoke about, you know, that this corporatist revolution, paraphrasing her again, she says is going to collapse if we refuse to buy what they're selling. And one of the things they're selling is their version of history, their wars, their weapons, and their, to quote her, their notion of inevitability, that this is all inevitable. And there's just nothing you should do, so just roll over and take it. And the first thing you have to do is say, I don't know, the first thing I want to do is say, you know, I may not, you know, be a perfect person, but I've lived right enough to tell war profiteers they can go to hell.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. You know, you're in Europe right now, and you travel around Europe and you see all these old castles. We lived in Germany for a year and would hear the stories from 1,500 years ago, that the cities, the little towns still told. And basically the local warlords would agree multi-generationally that Castle A would have an ongoing war with Castle B, at low level, you know, over hundreds of years, so that all of the serfs, all of the peasants would work as hard as they could to make sure that the castles got fancier and bigger and fancier and bigger, and there was more and more stuff for the guys who owned the castles, and it was a racket. And here we are again. It's the racket again.
Yeah, I think so. And I think, the idea that, if you really want, a future or a government where the government's sole function is to create a corporate feeding frenzy and to make it the best possible conditions for corporations to make money. Like, if that's what you expect or want out of your government, then, you know, vote Republican and, you know, let the Democrats do what they want and don't hold their feet to the fire. But if you want more from that, more from a government than that, and if you think that it's one thing to talk about privatizing Social Security, but if you privatize the very core functions of state, going to war, jailing, border patrol, interrogations, which means torture. I mean, if we're at a place now where not only it's okay to torture people, and it's not okay for the government to torture people, it's okay for the government to farm out torture to other businesses that can make a profit torturing people, and that's where we actually are, which is where we are right now, then I don't know of a polite way to talk about it, and I think it's immoral not to call it what it is.
Yeah. Well,
not to name it outright.
You've made a brilliant, thought-provoking, funny, entertaining, and at times thrilling movie about it, and I War Inc.
Well, the good thing is, if people want to keep it in the theaters, go this weekend. Because we don't. If people go now, we'll be able to keep it in the theaters and roll it out to the other cities. And if they don't, it'll kind of go, and you'll see it in DVD. But if we want to have some fun with it and keep it in the theaters for a while, it's at the Landmark and the Angelica starting this weekend. So if we fill out these theaters, we'll see if we can bring it to other cities.
Great. The Landmark and the Angelica in which cities?
In Los Angeles and New York.
In Los Angeles,
Landmark,
New York.
Landmark in Los Angeles and the Angelica in New York.
So to our listeners on K-Talk in Los Angeles, get out there to the Landmark, and to our listeners in New York, get to the Angelica. And there we go. John Cusack, War Inc. is the movie. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you so much. It was fun talking to you.
27 minutes past the hour. We'll be back with your calls right after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Okay. I appreciate your call, Cleaver. I'm sorry I couldn't sort a specific point out of that to react to, but I'm glad you're a peace activist. That is a fine thing. 45 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Tom Hartman. Helping you win the water cooler wars. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's Anything Goes Friday. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Sean Taylor is checking out our blog, trying to figure out who's going to get a copy of Cracking the Code, How to Win Hearts, Change Minds, and Restore America's Original Vision, autographed by me in hardcover at the end of the show today. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Bill in Santa Monica, California. Hey, Bill.
Oh, good morning. I am riveted by your shows. I switch back and forth to different views on the radio. There's about four different selections in the morning. I'm riveted to hear you get a lot of information. I really recommend your program. But I would love to hear you take on some of these contrary views in detail. And they never do it. I think they do that because each side...
What do you mean by contrary views?
there's views that, you know...
You mean that you would like to hear me have somebody on who's saying that we should drill in Anwar, or that abortion should become illegal, or something like that?
Well, to each of these issues, or most all of these issues, there's a contrary reason. When you hear, "Oh, we got if we drilled in Anwar, we would solve our problems," but then the other view is that it would take 10 years to ever get the oil from Anwar.
Right.
And there's reasons for most all issues in politics today that have two varying views,
yeah,
contrasting views, and they're never conflicted. They're never contrasted on a program.
Well, Bill, I would respectfully submit to you that you don't listen to my program then, because almost every single day I have a conservative on.
It's a great program.
Okay, then are you suggesting that there's a problem broader? I don't get it. Cause
more details, even the devilish details. Remember when I talk, that's where the problem is. We never get into that when we discuss politics today. And then a lot of times you get into history. Like when you talk about, let me give you an example. When you talked this morning about the castles 500 years ago, listen, that may have well went on, but that doesn't connect it today to today, what's going on today. And Bush didn't. What about the threat of radical Islam today? You don't ever address it. It's all Bush's fault.
Well, I'm sorry, Bill. I'm just getting it that you don't listen to our program. I mean, that you haven't heard my debates with David Horowitz, and you haven't heard my debates what's his name? There's just a whole long list of conservatives who have been on this show, neoconservatives, the architects of the Bush administration's foreign policy, guys who are in favor of our bombing Iran on a regular basis. I mean, if anything, that oddly enough, the same people who think that it's wonderful, and I agree, that Barack Obama suggests we should talk to our enemies, send me emails saying, "Why do you have these right-wingers on your show all the time? I don't want to hear from the enemy." I'm like, no, wait a minute. We need to have these discussions. We need to highlight these issues. We need to have both sides presented. And, you know, I want to model how to have a rational discussion with somebody on the other side. You know, yeah, my interview with John Cusack was not an argument. It's probably the first interview that I've had, or one of few in the last couple of weeks, where I wasn't, shouting with somebody, having, I'm sorry, Bill, you just don't listen to the show. Marty in Los Angeles. Hey, Marty.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I'm a big fan of yours, big fan of the program, but I have to vehemently disagree with you in a subject that's been discussed ad nauseum in the media recently, and that is consideration of Hillary Clinton on an Obama-Clinton ticket. I don't see how progressives and the progressive media can advocate for even that consideration when arguably she's enabled, and that's, you know, best case scenario. Worst case, she's at, you know, orchestrated, you know, race baiting, the strategy of race baiting, and, you know, charges that Obama is unpatriotic, and now her whole focus on the popular vote, which, as you know, is not the standard that the primary was based on. And even,
Marty, if you think that the way that Hillary Clinton has gone up against Barack Obama is inappropriate or harsh, you ain't seen nothing yet. I'm telling you, she has run a very, very restrained campaign. And as you know, I'll just lay it out here. I've been taking the position throughout this thing that I believe that my listeners have enough common sense to make up their own mind, and so I'm not gonna be one of those blowhards who tries to tell people how they should vote. But I will tell you what I have done. And that is, on two different occasions, I've heard Barack Obama give speeches, once his race speech in Philadelphia and one when he was here in Portland, that so inspired me that I went to his website and I gave him money. And I am waiting for Hillary Clinton to give me a speech or do something that will so inspire me that I will give her money. So I think that, you know, from that, I'm not making an endorsement and I'm not making a condemnation. I think that they're actually both very good candidates. I think it's also really important that we consider that Hillary Clinton has, I mean, this is not like John McCain not having to bring along Mike Huckabee on his ticket. I mean, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama are within a whisker of each other and have been throughout this whole process. And that's something that, at least in my lifetime, is unprecedented, or at least if it happened before, it happened before I was politically conscious. And I would say, and she has a huge constituency. There's a lot of people out there who are saying, you know, who are with her, particularly women. But beyond that, obviously she's reaching beyond women. And I think that I frankly think it's a ticket that could work. And I think it's a ticket that would heal America. I think that if he just turns away from her and says, nope, sorry, Joe Biden's my guy or whatever, you're going to have a lot of people who are going to feel really damaged, really wounded by that. And
I would suggest to you, you're going to have a lot of Obama's core supporters, a very significant percentage. I'm not saying a majority, like myself, who, Tom, as a progressive, she has done things which seem antithetical to everything that progressives have stood for years.
And Kennedy's supporters were saying the same thing when he picked LBJ.
Okay.
And you know, what happened was he got elected. Kennedy supporters said, okay, you know, we'll go along. It's just the vice presidency. I realize the vice presidency is a little more potent now than it was then, but, you know, it'll go along. And LBJ actually turned out to be a very good president. And I've seen Hillary Clinton get more and more progressive throughout this campaign, and I think she is not her husband. I think she's a lot better than her husband, frankly. So we'll have to, you know, Marty, we'll have to respectfully disagree on that. And I appreciate your call. And I've heard all the arguments on both sides, and I'm not saying that's the dream ticket. I'm just saying it's a ticket.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman. Call 866-303-2270.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program. We will be giving away a copy of Cracking the Code, How to Win Hearts, Change Minds, and Restore America's Original Vision, to the author of Sean's favorite blog post today at tomhartman.com, at the show blog, the blog for today, right on our homepage. Apropos of our last caller, last Sunday I wrote a short, a blog, basically, suggesting that Obama should consider Hillary Clinton as his VP. I sent it off to Air America to post it. We actually wrote it on Sunday and sent it off on Monday. It took him a couple of days. It was Wednesday by the time it got up. And I think in some ways by that time the dynamic of all of this, and frankly even some of my thinking on it, had subtly changed, but not entirely. But what has startled me more than more than anything else, certainly more than the all the email that I've gotten in response to it, which is running roughly 30 to 70%, 30% saying, great idea, and 70% saying, are you crazy? The emails, is the roughly 10% or so of the emails that I've gotten who are expressing the concern that with Clinton or any other establishment or machine candidate on the ticket, much like LBJ was the establishment, the machine guy on the JFK ticket, that Barack Obama would face a fate identical to that of JFK. It is truly startling to me the number of people who have suggested to me that if Hillary was on the ticket, that that would mean that Barack Obama would not serve out his term. And, or, you know, there's also a number of people who have simply expressed that absent of concern about Hillary Clinton. And what this says to me is something about the psyche of our country. And I think it's something that we need to speak about. And therefore I'm going to right now. I've often talked about the woundings, the great woundings this country has suffered in my lifetime. There was Vietnam, there was Kent State, the assassinations of Martin Luther King, John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, the unconstitutional and illegal hijacking of a state's electoral process. And the Constitution says each state shall decide how to send their electors to Washington, D.C. Well, in 2000, the U.S. Supreme Court decided how the state of Florida was going to send their electors to Washington, D.C. They ruled in favor of Bush when he sued Al Gore and Bush v. Gore. A great wounding of Americans. This was a coup. There's no other word for it. And Scalia saying, hey, it's old history. Get over it. We've been wounded by the lies and the warmongering that led up to the election of 2002. We've been wounded by the illegal bombardments and invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq. We were wounded by the theft of the election of 2004 in Ohio, and it's really now starting to come to light. We were wounded by the failure of the Democratic leadership in the House and the Senate to hold the Bush administration accountable for their crimes or to defund their war when they took power in 2006. We've been wounded by the death of thousands of Americans in New York City and in New Orleans, both the result of explicit policies and actions of madmen. One, an act of commission, the other, an act of omission, and I would submit an intentional act of omission. And now we're being wounded by this long and protracted primary campaign and the often not so subtle use of both race and gender as a weapon by partisans on both sides. Frankly, not so much the candidates, but certainly the partisans, and the never-ending goading of the press. Make a little more money, get a few more eyeballs. Of the campaigns and the electorates, just to extend the process to wring another day of higher than normal advertising revenue out of the system. I'm telling you, Americans have PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. Carl Jung, the brilliant Viennese psychiatrist, actually, I think he was, suggested that we come into the world with certain images, inclinations, temperaments, concepts, archetypes, pre-wired into our brains. He suggested that these are the result of evolution, that they're passed from generation to generation, and over time they're subtly molded. In fact, one of his most famous quotes in describing this, he wrote it in 1928, he said, the whole nature of man presupposes woman, both physically and spiritually. His system is tuned into woman from the start, just as it is prepared for a quite definite world into which he is already inborn in him as a virtual image. Likewise, parents, wife, children, birth, and death are inborn in him as virtual images, as psychic aptitudes. These have individual predestinations. We must therefore think of these images as lacking in solid content, hence as unconscious. They only acquire solidity, influence, and eventual consciousness in the encounter with empirical facts. In other words, we're born with this stuff kind of in our brain, and when we interact with the world, we make it real. And the facts that we're encountering right now are these woundings of our culture. We have found in modern science now that genes are actually mutable, that they change over time. The genes in your body change over time, including genes for things that control how we think, like the levels of neurotransmitters like serotonin and dopamine. And while women are born with all the eggs in their ovaries at birth, men are continuously producing new sperm whose DNA varies over time and with experience, and possibly even the DNA of a woman's eggs can change over time, or ova, medical term, through not yet understood mechanisms. I would submit to you that, therefore, those born after the death of JFK and Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King came into the world with some faint shadow, a Jungian archetype, a memory echo of that great wounding already built into them. And those of us old enough to remember it are still wounded by it and all the other woundings. In Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, in Prophet's Way, and Walking Your Blues Away, in the books that I've written about culture and psychotherapy, and in some of my IDD books, in fact, I've pointed out that our culture is based on the assumptions of sin and punishment. There are cultures that are not. The older cultures among us, the ancient people, Aboriginal people, Indigenous people, people who have existed without prisons and without police for tens of thousands of years, and many of these cultures are still around, instead of assuming the evilness of humans and the necessity of punishment, they assume the goodness of humans and the necessity of balance and harmony. We see a criminal as a person acting out the original sinful nature of humans, and see the community as having the obligation of delivering the stern and painful corrective of the penal system, or tough love. Older cultures instead see these criminals, in quotes, as a person who's fallen out of balance. And the job of the community is to bring that person back into balance through teaching them or healing them. So here we are, wounded and in pain. And it's bringing us back into excruciating touch with the shadow of our society's worst moments. I'm startled by the number of emails I get that are pretty explicitly calling, as our last caller did, essentially, for Hillary Clinton to be punished for her sins on the campaign trail. Others have called for the same for Obama, although typically they don't point to things Obama has said. In generalization, he's a sexist, but they all point to things that his partisans have said or done. And you can find the arguments for these respective camps, and I lay this out in an op-ed that I'm by and large sharing with you right now that's over at the Air America website. It's at tomhartman.com. And you can find these. Democratic Underground, for example, has some very, very articulate spokespeople on, you know, making the argument for Barack Obama and equally trashing Hillary Clinton. And over at Carolyn Kay, who's a dear friend of mine, over at her website, makethemaccountable.com, you'll find a long list of the great things about Hillary Clinton and how terrible Barack Obama is. So I've gotten a lot of emails on both sides saying, you know, this person's great, the other one's terrible. No one, not one email I've received so far has called for the person that they don't like to be healed. Instead, they're all calling for them to be punished or discarded. My original op-ed was an attempt to bring into our national conversation the topic of healing. This is an older culture idea, and we're a younger culture. I mean, I'm part of it too, right? But here we are. We're 3 or 4% of the world's population. We're consuming a quarter of the world's oil. We're producing 30 to 40% of the world's waste. We're killing ourselves and others. Every other species on Earth produces waste that is used as food by some other species. Every single one, except us. We're the only ones who think growth is some wonderful thing. Every other life form knows that it's cancer. So here we are, crazy by birth, in a culture that's been crazy for 7,000 years, carrying the shadows and archetypes of wars going back to Gilgamesh. I'm telling you, it's time for us to step back from this talk of punishment and begin embracing the notion of healing. And this is not New Age feel-good gibberish. It's essential action we must take if we're going to stop this cancer in our society.
The Tom Hartman Program, the true people's radio.
Tom Hartman.
She sends it down. Anything goes.
21 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman program, brought to you in part by the Teamsters, fighting to stop the unfair trade deal with Colombia. You can find out more at teamster.org. Well, let's see, on our blog, there's one post, Tom, you're such a healer. There's another, Tom, you're such an ass. And pretty much the same in the chat room. It's interesting. I appreciate all the feedback. I really do. Sarah in Northern California. Sarah, you called in before I started that riff, and Andrew says to me that you said something almost like what I was saying, at least a part of it, before I started talking. So you're up first. What's up?
Thank you so much for taking my call. I really appreciate the intelligence that you bring to the whole arena here. And your previous caller before your talk, you responded to him about the JFK LBJ analogy, and I was a bit horrified because that has been a long-term concern of mine. And because I think if we put Hillary Clinton in as the VP, we are setting Barack up for assassination.
By the Clinton family?
By extremists in the right wing who much prefer the corporate power and position.
Well, let's say if you put Joe Biden in, who voted for the bankruptcy bill, you know, and has a number of good corporate friends on his side, or if you put in, there are virtually no Democratic candidates short of Dennis Kucinich who are relatively free of strong corporate influence. It's the only, you got to raise, you know, $6 million a year to be a senator. It's just there's no way around it.
Well, John Edwards ends up being our best next alternative. And like you said,
well, okay, I agree,
maybe a month or so ago,
you got
the press really backed out of John Edwards long before the popular, you know, interest in him declined. They were partly responsible for that.
No, I don't disagree, Sarah. And let me just, you know, say on the record, Barack Obama, if he wins this nomination, and it certainly looks like he's going to, or maybe that he already has, but still, Florida and Michigan do need to be resolved by the Rules Committee. But if Barack Obama wins this nomination, he has every right to pick whoever he damn well pleases. And, you know, my op-eds aside, and I would hope that he would pick the person who will be the very best person, not just to win against John McCain, but also to govern this country. And there's a wide variety of opinion about whether or not that would or wouldn't be Hillary Clinton. And I can build a strong argument on both sides, frankly. I'm just, whoever it is, and whoever is the Democratic nominee, presidential and vice presidential, I'm going to support. But I'm concerned as to your point that, and this is, as I'm saying, 10% of the emails that I got in response to this thing that I wrote last weekend and didn't finally get published until Wednesday, unfortunately, because it really should have gotten out, you know, Monday when it was, you know, the news cycle kind of moved beyond it, you know, about Obama should ask Hillary to be on the ticket, even if she says no, just to begin the healing of the party. And that was my point. And I'm just surprised that about 10% of the people, more or less, who respond to me are saying you're setting him up to be killed. And I'm like, wow. I mean, this is I realize that even talking about, the assassination of political figures is something that is very, very difficult, very delicate. There's even legal issues around doing on the radio or in the media or whatever. And obviously none of us would ever, God forbid, advocate that in any way for anybody. But it just startles me how many people are afraid of it, are terrified of it. And I think that what it is that ghost of John and Robert in the primaries was assassinated, and Martin Luther King, the African-American, that were projecting onto Barack Obama the woundings that we experienced, and even those who are young enough that they weren't born when those three men were assassinated, still, I think that archetype has now become part of the zeitgeist of America, the spirit of America, the spirit of these times, and I think that it's a projection. I don't think that it's a reality, and I think that the extent to which we continue to be frantic about it, we give it power, and I think that we need to say it out loud and let go of it.
Tom, if you'd let me make another point here, with all due respect, I think you're being a little naive. I think when you talk about PTSD in the culture, I think that's real. And if you take that analogy a little further, because someone starts being conscious of wanting to turn a direction, that doesn't mean you take a drug addict or a drunk and put a drink in their hand or put them in an arena that will support a weak direction of movement. And the truth is, when you called Bush election a coup, I think that was accurate. And there's been an enormous amount of track being laid in our political system that supports subversion of what we have taken as more of a democracy.
I agree with all of those points. I'm sorry, we just have a couple seconds left, but I'm asking you to address my concern about your concern that if Hillary's on the ticket, that means that somebody's going to come gunning for Barack Obama.
I am. That's why I'm calling you naive. I work as a therapist. And I'm very aware of looking at the health and also acknowledging the weaknesses.
So you think that's going to bring out that shadow in the other side rather than just in us?
Yes.
Okay. All right. I got it. And, Sarah, I don't actually disagree with you. And that's some real food for thought. Thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. Bill O'Reilly finally found a home when Fox News came along. The main fact on the factor is the facts are often wrong. Slander those who can't defend themselves without an ounce of shame. Make everything about himself, and that's how he became.
Vicious, and that is with a capital V, person who's blinded by ideology.
You might be someone who'll dig it. You might be O'Reilly's kind. Especially if you're a bigot with a closed and tiny mind.
Shut
up! If you have no use for reason, then you'll love the way he acts. He'll tell you what you want to hear, regardless of the facts.
They're not facts.
Bill O'Reilly finally found a home when Fox News came along. A place he could ignore the truth and get the facts all wrong. Faced with the truth he can't refute, then he'll call you a name.
You're a lunatic.
He'll thumb his nose, the legend goes that that's how he became.
A snide, condescending idiot.
The big giant head. The big giant head.
Well, regularly beating the big giant head in the ratings, the Tom Hartman radio program. Oh, amazing. Yeah, well, what can you say?
So, all those clowns over at the liberal radio network, we could incarcerate them immediately.
Will
you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains?
Oh, man. All righty. Yeah. Louise just shared an email with me here. She says, with regard to Hillary... Obama versus Hillary, punishment or healing. This is the op-ed that I wrote today, which I basically shared with you in the first segment of this hour. She says, both have a perfect right to run until the last vote is cast. Both have stimulated more interest by Democrats and potential Democrats than ever before. They both need to be heard. Both have an exceptional race, have run an exceptional race, and they deserve respect and to be heard. I think a combined ticket would be unbeatable. As for Bill Clinton, let him serve out Hillary's Senate seat. Wouldn't that be interesting? Bill Clinton. Oh, that was a blog post. I'm sorry. I thought that was an email. So that's a post on our blog, on our homepage at tomhartman.com. Vr interesting. 1-866-303-2270, as I said, our phone number, Jerry in Spring Hill, Florida. Hey, Jerry. By the way, anything goes Friday, any topic you want to talk about. What's up?
Well, yesterday I was watching C-SPAN.
Yeah.
And something I couldn't figure out what was going on. And the announcer comes on and explains what was going on. It turns out that somebody had stuck a word into a bill that was going through that they were waiting to vote on.
Mm-hmm.
And that kills the bill. If that one word is in there, the word is promptly.
Hmm.
And I'd never heard of that.
That's, I don't know about that either, Jerry. That's a great question to ask to Bernie, you know, somebody who's been involved in the legislative process forever.
Maybe one of your listeners heard about it, but yesterday was, as much as I watched C-SPAN, if that word appears there, they said it kills the bill.
Huh. Interesting. Well, we'll have to look into it. Jerry, thanks for the heads up there. I appreciate it. George in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, George.
Hey, Tom.
I'm going to switch gears here to gas prices.
That's fine.
I was watching the C-SPAN with all the ExxonMobil CEOs defending the high gas prices because of supply and demand. But how is demand actually figured? I mean, is demand actually up now from May of 2000? Do we actually know that?
Yeah, there's more cars. And
Is military gasoline figured in there to demand?
I'll bet it is. Yeah, actually, the military is the largest single user of petroleum products in the United States, ahead of the commercial airlines.
So if we wouldn't be actively at war, gas prices would probably be down.
You're probably right. You know, I hadn't thought it through to that, but A to B, B to C. Yeah, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, because I've tried to find it on the internet on what ExxonMobil uses for their term supply and demand, and I can't even find an equation or whatever how they define how much gas they're going to need. I mean, to me, it sounds like they always go lowball so they can keep it high.
Yeah, I'm sure they're a major supplier to the military, and I do know that the United States military is the largest single consumer of gasoline or petroleum products, gas and diesel, in the United States. Amazing. Interesting thought, George. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Harvey in Berkeley, California. Hey, Harvey.
Hi, Tom. I'd like to talk about how the nuclear industry is trying to build more plants here in California and calling themselves green, and I'd like to
tell you
why it's a bad investment.
Sure.
Well, first of all, it's such a big investment, and the payback period is so long. It's about a 30-year investment, and there's all these new technologies coming along that are going to be inexpensive and renewable, and I don't think that we should lock ourselves into a 30-year investment because the taxpayers will end up holding the bag on this. And also, they call themselves green. Well, you know, the mining, refining, transportation, storage, and guarding of nuclear material creates a lot of greenhouse gases. And as far as the water is concerned, turns out that 35 cities in America are starting to experience water shortages.
Right.
And
nuclear power consumes vast amounts of water. Harvey, the biggest argument against nuclear power is the Price-Anderson Act. Nuclear power would not exist in the United States if the federal government hadn't come in through Price-Anderson and said there is no insurance company in the world that will insure a nuclear power plant because they are so dangerous and the consequences of a meltdown or an accident or a failure are so vast that therefore you and I, Harvey, the people of the United States, will insure the nuclear power plants at no cost. And that's the only thing that makes the industry viable. And we should repeal the Price-Anderson Act and then say to the nuclear industry, okay, guys, good luck. And they would just they just have to pack up and walk off.
One thing that you're absolutely right, and one thing that's happening is that they're actually having to close down nuclear plants because of water shortages in various cities, like here in North Carolina. The lake went down 5 feet. If it goes down one more feet that the nuclear plant is on, it'll have to shut the plant. And solar electric roof shingles and solar panels use no water in the production of clean electricity. So I think it's imperative, especially with our water shortages, that we stay away from nuclear and go towards solar.
Amen. Well said, Harvey. Thank you very much. Jim in Flint, Michigan, you have an answer to our promptly question.
Yes, Tom, that's my understanding that actually is referring to something that's unique to the House of Representatives, and that is something that's called a motion to recommit. That with the motion to recommit, if it is asking to send the bill back to the committee, if it says promptly, then that means it actually goes back to the committee and has to start all over in the committee. Mm-hmm. As opposed to if motion to, you know, says that it shall be referred to the committee, quote, forthwith, unquote, then it actually stays on the floor of the House and is then revoted on as an amendment.
Oh, that's interesting. So this is parliamentary procedure that's using arcane legal language.
Well, it's a very technical language, but yes, and what that effectively does is it does kill the bill.
Yeah, interesting.
Because it's very unlikely that
because it sends it back to committee, and at that point, the committee is just going to say, okay, we're not going to recycle this thing.
Bingo.
Yeah, okay. Jim, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it. I'm telling you, I have the smartest listeners on earth for this program. It ain't me. It's my listeners. Bob in San Luis Obispo.
Yes, Tom. Interesting look on the McClatchy News Service today. They talked about a very successful operation the Amaliki government in Iraq pulled off, and they went in and took over the entire operation of the ports at Basra. And so I'd like to hear how the right's going to spend this. It's a successful military operation, a successful government operation of the Iraqi government,
by nationalizing private enterprise.
Now, were those ports being run by American companies?
I don't know. They didn't say in the article.
Because I thought that most of the larger facilities in the country were being run by, you know, Halliburton, Bechtel, the, you know, the usual characters.
I don't think the article specified.
Yeah, that's fascinating, the nationalization. I will have to look for that story, Bob, and maybe we can get into a riff on it next week. Thanks for the heads up.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. 866-303-2270. Glenn in Canby, Oregon. Hey, Glenn.
Hello, Tom. I just finished cracking the code. Enjoyed it very much.
Well, thank you.
And but, you know, I was wondered if you might cast a light on how the Republican Party shanghaied the word expression right and the Democratic Party got left, you know, sort of like the rectus sinister thing in Latin.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's difficult to have right and wrong in your vocabulary and right and left in your vocabulary and not have left somehow imply wrong or incorrect. Do you know if there was a moment in time when the right was commandeered by the Repubs?
I don't. I really don't. If I just had to take a wild guess based on how these things generally emerge, it would probably be that, you know, back in the British House of Parliament, you know, one side of the room was one party and the other side of the room was the other party, or perhaps even in the United States House of Representatives, and one was on the right side and the other was on the left side.
Could have been as innocuous as that.
I'm guessing it probably was. I don't think that this was something, you know, it's certainly nothing recent. I mean, this goes back a long ways. How far back it goes, though, I'm sure somebody, you know, Sean may be able to track it down with Wikipedia or Google here, and I'll let you know. Or maybe one of our listeners will know. Glenn, thanks a lot for raising the question. Rod in Miami, Florida. Hey, Rod, we got a minute here before the break. What's up?
Hey, John, good to talk to you. I think you're absolutely right, actually, on a quick comment on your the way the Senate is laid out is the right, the left, versus Democrats and Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, the comment I wanted to make is I'm tired of hearing how these oil executives keep talking about the free market and the fair market, and that's what's driving up these oil prices. Well, if that's the case, then do we not as a people have the right to boycott ExxonMobil and Chevron and all of these top oil producers and basically make them lower their prices?
Yeah, except that as long as we need to continue using their products, if you stop buying for a day or even for a week, you're just going to have to buy a whole bunch more the next day or the next week.
I'm not talking about oil in general. I'm talking about Exxon and Mobil.
Oh, okay, yeah.
You can go buy from Shell, BP, Citgo.
Do a boycott. Instead of a boycott, do a buycott. Buy from Citgo. Citgo is owned by the Venezuelan government.
Exactly. If we can stay away from Exxon, we can make them lower our prices. Everybody in America can do it,
the problem
it's not
is
a hard
that,
choice.
The problem is that Citgo is only available in some places. There's only one, maybe two Citgo stations, for example, in all of Portland.
Shell, there's a bunch of them out there. Just stay away from Exxon and Mobil, and I think we can do it.
Okay, Rod, thanks a lot. 45 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman. Uncommon sense from the radical middle. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I see trees of green. Red roses too. I see them blue for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And whenever I hear this song, I think of my dad. It was his favorite song. We played it at his funeral. Hey, thanks so much to Louise Hartman, to my producer Sean Taylor, to Chris Rosen, Lauren Kirshner, Sean Kenzie, Marcus Hellman at Air America, to Sue Nethercutt and the folks in our chat room, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to the program. By the way, quick heads up, Thursday of next week, I will be in San Francisco. We're going to get some Barack Obama pledge delegates and some Hillary Clinton delegates. And John Scott and Angie and I are going to sit down and have a conversation with them. This is a fundraiser for the California Democratic Party. And $10 at the door, and you can get the information over at green960.com. So check that out. Real quickly, Patty in Plymouth, Michigan, knows the origin of the left-right Patty, what is it?
Yes, hi, Tom. I was in London in 1993. I saw the House of Parliament, and I understand, I learned at that point that it was where the party sat. It's the wing in which the party sat.
Right, so my guess was right. Interesting.
Yep.
Okay, thank you, Patty. I appreciate that. And Ellen Ratner will be with us in just a second. But, Sean, you have selected your favorite blog post from today's from our TomHartmann.com website from today's show entry.
I have indeed. It's from Daryl MK4, who says, I always enjoy listening to your program during the week. You've made me more aware of what is actually going on in the country. My uncle believes George Bush is the best thing that ever happened, not just to the U.S., but the world. Your show has given me talking points to challenge him and attempt to shut him down. I'm very excited to see what you talk about when the debate hoopla is all said and done.
Thank you, Sean, and thank you, Daryl MK4. Congratulations. You win a copy of Cracking the Code, my book, How to Win Hearts, Change Minds, and Restore America's Original Vision. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com, on the line with us. Hey, Ellen, what's going on in the world?
You know, on Fridays, not every Friday, but when I occasionally can get it together, I give a chutzpah award, and I got to give it to the Republican Party today. They just sent out an email that says, as Memorial Day nears, Republicans offer solutions to help lower gas prices while Democrats do nothing. And, of course, they refer to the Pelosi premium.
That is chutzpah. Yeah. That's incredible.
They get my award today.
Yeah.
The president comes a little close today. He had a South Lawn ceremony this morning urging Congress to act on free trade agreements, and he had people in the audience, diplomats from Colombia, Panama, South Korea, and he said 40% of the growth in this country last year came from exports. So I say play to our strengths. One of the strengths during this period of time is to continue to export products. The growth that we had during some quarters, recent quarters, was the result of exports. Seems like we ought to be working to create more exports.
Yeah, let's export Bush and Cheney. I mean, you know, we've exported Halliburton. They've moved to Dubai, so.
No, they're in Abu Dhabi. But
Abu Dhabi.
Part of the Emirates.
Excuse me, Abu Dhabi. Okay, but I can make a long list. You know, let's export John Boehner. Let's export Newt Gingrich. Oh my. Okay, so what else is going on?
As you know, yesterday there was a Defense Authorization Act that passed. Some unnoticed provisions is actually the House voted 218 to 192, 15 Republicans, to adopt something that would require video recording of interrogations by the Department of Defense.
Hmm. Interesting.
Yesterday, the House also adopted, as part of the Defense Authorization Act, a 234 to 183 vote that would require congressional approval of any agreement between the United States and Iraq making commitments to Iraq security. As you know, there's the Status of Forces Agreement, the SOFA Agreement. Generally, they say that that does not need congressional approval, but they're saying that this would actually give congressional, that this goes beyond it.
Wow.
By the way,
if I may just interrupt you for just a moment, I just got a note here from one of our listeners. We've been trying to figure out where the terms left and right came from. And he says the term originates, this is from the 10th grade history class. The term originates from the French Revolution. Apparently the British picked it up from there when liberal deputies from the Third Estate generally sat to the left of the president's chair, a habit which began in the Estates General of 1789. The nobility, members of the Second Estate, generally sat to the right of the of the president's chair. And it's still a tradition in the French Assembly Nationale. And apparently in England and apparently here too. Anyhow, as you were saying, the next story. I'm sorry.
A couple other stories here. A person from your neck of the woods, Jenny Greenleaf, just endorsed. She's a superdelegate, Barack Obama. The Obama campaign say they are 56 delegates away from the Democratic nomination.
Yeah, I think that they're going to nail down within the next couple of weeks, don't you?
We shall see.
Don't forget,
the 31st is next Saturday.
That's
right.
It's going to be a very significant day.
It is going to be very significant. You might even want to do a special broadcast that day.
Yeah, next Saturday is the 31st is going to be the day on which we learn whether the Clinton campaign is waging peace or waging war.
Exactly. Exactly. Also, it looks as if the, as you know, there was a huge problem with the National Republican Congressional Committee that they were short one year almost $1 million and the other year about $740,000. Well, now it looks like there's a couple other PACs. There was this Prosperity Helps PAC Prosperity Helps Ensure Liberty PAC. They're also short of money, and there's a couple other little PACs from the Republicans that are also short of money. So it looks like some of this appropriating money for personal use was done on several in several areas of the Republicans.
Why am I not surprised? Ellen Ratto with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Ellen.
Thank you.
Don't forget, my friends, get out there, get active. Democracy begins with you. Are we doing a different... on Monday's program, it'll be a best of Tom Hartman. On Tuesday, I'll be debating Michael Ledeen from the American Enterprise Institute, Carrie Lucas from the Independent Women's Forum. And don't forget, democracy begins with you, my friends. Tag, you're it. Have a great Memorial Day weekend. Don't forget our fallen vets.